All right, this is Emily Sweeney of the Boston Globe. I'm author of the new book, Gangland Boston, and you're listening to Gangland Wire.
Former Kansas City Police Department intelligence detective and now attorney Gary Jenkins produced four documentary films, most recently Gangland Wire. Creator of smartphone app entitled Kansas City Mob Tours. Download it now. If you like what you hear, go to ganglandwire.com. Navigate to the shop page. We need you to put a hit out on our donate button. Gangland Wire True Crime Stories is produced at the Big Dumb Fun Show Studio 4. And now, here's Gary Jenkins.
Hello, all you wiretappers out there. We're not in the Big Dumb Fun Show studio in the classic old Ice House building in Kansas City. We're out in Las Vegas in the Plaza Hotel because we're at the Mob World Summit 2018. It's 20,000. Should be 2018, shouldn't it, Aaron?
I think you... I was actually jotting notes down there right before we went into the episode to make sure that Gary remembered to say...
Well, hello, Aaron. Say hello, Aaron.
Hello, Aaron.
That's our little stick, isn't it?
Well, we didn't even know it was a stick until we did another remote over at Stanford's where we talked with Craig Glazier, who the king of Sting.
Yeah.
And one of the fans of the Gangland Wire podcast walked up and said to Gary, you didn't say hello, Aaron, at the beginning. And sometimes when we do these kind of remotes and stuff, Gary gets excited and
yeah.
He dives right into things. And
well, we're not in the Big Dumb Fun Show studio in the classic old Ice House
no,
building.
So much more comfortable.
My son was making fun of me for saying that. But when I'm not there, I kind of lose my track, train of thought. But we're here in the 22nd floor of the Plaza Hotel in downtown Las Vegas. The Mob World Summit is just over, and we have one of the guests that was here, an old friend of mine. We first met in 2013, I believe, at the MobCon that both of us spoke at. It's my good friend, Ron Fino. Hi, Ron.
Hi, Gary. Thank you very much for inviting me.
It was really good to have you here. I was glad that you were able to come out and help Larry Henry with this, because it's we try to keep getting together and keep this mob stuff, mob information going.
right. Well, I try to point out what really happened.
Yeah.
What happens with the mob, and I know that we all get something wrong, and I'm not here for that. But I'm here more to tell my story, of growing up in the mob and how eventually I went with the FBI and CIA.
Yeah, that's that, it, folks. This is one heck of a story. It's we've had like Frank Culotta, who's been on the show, who was a real deal criminal, shall we say. We had Andrew DiDonato, who was a real deal criminal, Frank Calabrese Jr. They were all real deal criminals who then got caught a case of some kind, and the FBI flipped them, and then they became informants, or really mainly they became cooperating witnesses. They worked a little bit. Now, Ron's story is different. It's a lot different. It's a little more like Red Wimette, who just went in and volunteered his services one day to the FBI because he didn't like the things the outfit guys in Chicago were doing. And Ron has a similar story. Ron, why don't you start out a little bit about maybe your growing up, your childhood, because you were born into it.
Yes, I was born in Buffalo, New York in 1946. Early in my life, I didn't have a father. The reason I say that, as I was told, he went to the army. My mother had to raise me. We were very poor. We were on welfare. And one of the things that always bothered me was we would get this oleo, it was called, and it had a red dot in the middle, and you had to squeeze it to get color yeah. to it. Oh, it was bad. I mean, this stuff was really bad.
It's not real butter.
No, it was bad. To this day, that's something that bothered me. But, we didn't look as children at being poor.
Yeah.
Because you don't think about that, but we were very poor. My mother used to go shoveling snow with me just to make a living. Mm. We'd have to go out shoveling snow in Buffalo, New York to make a living. And I was a little thief. I would steal vegetables. I'd steal chickens. You had no choice. You were trying to survive. Finally, we go to the Army fort one time. We're driving out with my aunts and my mother. Little did I realize it was Attica Prison.
You said was the Army Fort. Yeah. That's a good
one. So we go there, and I'm just a little boy, and I see this Danny Sanzanese outside the wall gardening. And I go to my mother, and my aunt said, hey, Uncle Dan's in the Army, too. But anyway, my father was, in those days, a soldier, eventually became a capo. In the Magadino family, which we refer to as the Magadino family.
And that was the Buffalo. That was the Boston Buffalo.
Yeah. They were quite large, by the way, a lot bigger than people realize. A
really strong family, yeah, I've read that.
And they took in Toronto, and they went all the way through to Binghamton and parts of Pennsylvania. Russell Buffalino and Billy came from the Magadino family. Uh-huh. So they were very, very powerful. And I mean, I remember meeting, I don't remember meeting. My mother took me to see Stefano. I remember vaguely meeting with him, and he patted me on the head, and I guess he was pretty cheap because my brother was upset he only gave me $5. I mean, he was tight with a buck. But anyway, I went through a normal life. I didn't grow up, in that time with the mob. I knew of them. And of course, we didn't call them mob. We called them uncles. They were always my uncles. I went through a normal high school life, and eventually, my father's home, I would make the rounds with him. He would go on various days when I was off of school, and we'd go to various restaurants, talk with the various mobsters, check the book. We would go to the bookmaking joints where they had the bars, and the guys sitting in their shorts answering the telephone. And that was my first experience. But as time went by, I started working construction. While I was going to school, and summertime would be for work in construction, and my father became the acting boss of the Magadino family. People started changing their attitudes. They started looking with more reverence upon you, which of course I don't buy. I don't buy that kind of garbage. I've never been someone that's proud of the stupid things like that, or ego driven.
Yeah. Now, at one point in time, I'm always curious about this. And they did a Sopranos episode on this. When the children become teenagers, as you just talked about, and you get your first job, when did it? How was that realization? How did that come to you that your father was, had some understanding of the mafia? You know, when I was a child, I had no understanding of the mafia or the mob. But, yeah, you had to get some understanding. How did that?
A lot of it, actually, the beginning was from the newspapers. Of what was being said.
Yeah.
I don't know the validity of it, but or how valid it was, but that's where I was picking it up. My father came out. We had the Appalachia. Now, my father didn't go, but a number of his associates, Freddie Rendaccio, Rosario Carlisi, were down there, and Magadino himself, and Peter.
All over the paper.
Yeah, I did know Peter quite well, Peter Magadino, and he was always to be a gentleman.
Mm-hmm.
But now I'm getting older, and I'm going to school. And my father's now the acting boss, and I'm offered a position in the Laborers International Union, Laborers Local 210 in Buffalo, as a business agent. And it was a great opportunity for me.
Oh, yeah.
I went in, but the problem that I had is I was limited what I could do. They wanted me just to drive around, don't say anything to anybody, just drive around and notice things. Well, that's not doing my job.
Yeah.
That was very bothersome from the beginning. The other problem I had was some of the people. One guy would come, I'm not going to mention his name, but he would come and dressed to tens. I mean, I never seen it. Every day he had a new sport coat on. I'd never seen that before. But he didn't work either. It was very little work. Now, I became close to the business manager at that time, Salvatore Bongiovanni, who I liked. He did know the business, and he was the teacher. He became a teacher of... for me about laborers, workers, things. He really was not a bad guy, but he was controlled. Vic Rendaccio, who was the brother of Freddie Rendaccio, ran the union. He was the mobster, and he was the secretary treasurer. At first, we never got along. Later on, we ended up getting along. And this was going on for a couple of years, and I couldn't take it anymore. And I had a fight with him over that, where I decided to run for office because I seen workers suffering. Workers were not getting the jobs. The normal workers would get the bull jobs, and the organized crime people would get all the gravy. And there's a lot of people that couldn't get jobs because they weren't connected.
This was the laborers union. What kind of jobs, like?
Well, we did everything from demolition up to survey work, grade foreman work. But it's a wide area. Tunnel workers, that comes under the laborers, mason tenders. It's a very it's one of the first guys on the job and the last people off.
Okay,
that's them and the Teamsters. That's why they had the control points in construction between the two.
Were these a lot of state jobs?
Well, you did state, federal. Yeah, we did a lot of what we refer to as Davis-Bacon jobs. That's federally prevailing wage rate jobs. And in those days, there was a lot of private work. Later on, it became non-union because they priced themselves out with conditions, things like that. But I ended up eventually saying I'm going to run. Well, Vic Rondaccio had me fired. That was the first thing. And it's making the news. My father thought I was crazy. I'm going to get killed. Now, he's no longer the boss.
Yeah.
He was ousted. He thought I was going to get killed, and he kept telling me that. He goes and cuts a deal with Danny Sanzanese, John Camilleri, who's dead now. They killed him, and a few others, that they were going to bolt and support me. Well, eventually Sammy Frenchmore, who was now the boss, said, okay, but just keep it clean. Well, we go in the election, and they never suspected it, but we won 2-1. It was that big. The problem I had is I didn't know the promises my father made to some of these people. That I did not like. I was very upset because Danny Sanzanese was a bulldog at a china shop, one of the most ruthless, arrogant people, Danny Sanzanese, and his father. I mean, he was, to me, he was a sick individual because he didn't care about anybody but himself and his own family. That bothered me a lot. Because I've seen too many cases where workers are not taken care of.
Yeah.
I thought I won an election here.
So you're the business agent.
I'm the business manager at this time.
Or business manager.
Yeah, I won the joint position of business manager, secretary, treasurer. But then I was told to give it up and that I had to give Danny Sanzanese Jr. the secretary treasurer's job. Finally, there comes a time after about 2 months in office, I go to a sit-down. And we had various mobsters at the table. Sammy Frenchmore, the boss, was there. And Roy Carlisi, who was a very powerful man. His brother became the boss in Chicago, Sammy Waynes. And he originally came out of Chicago. He's the one that sits me down and tells me, from now on, you're going to listen to us. You are not to act on your own. Nothing you do will be done without our approval. And I told him, Sam, I got a little irate, and I started talking a little back to him. Boy, did he get upset. I thought he was going to kill me on the spot. I mean, this guy really went after me. Don't you ever talk to us like that. Who do you think you are, you young punk? You know, he's getting very tough with me. Now, I'm not a, I could be tough too, but I'm not stupid.
Yeah.
it's a kiss of death. But it was at that time that convinced me more so than any. Because I did do some previous work with the CIA going back in the 60s. But it was at that time, right after I won the election, that I decided I better do something. And I'm playing tennis with an FBI agent, and I was very, very critical of him. Very critical that the Bureau's not doing anything. And I told him, that you should be ashamed of yourself. He told me, Ronnie, if people like you helped, we could do something. I says, I'll help, but there's a proviso. I never want to be known, and I never want anybody going after my family. And that means my father and everybody. I'd have to have those assurances before I did it. And they gave me assurances that that would not be the case, and that they would honor that request, which they always did, by the way. They never violated that request.
So you were elected then to the labor union.
Yes.
What year was that?
That was 1973.
And within 2 months?
Within two months.
These other guys, the guy from Chicago, they all come and they tell you're not really in charge.
That's correct. That's our union. That's correct.
And so, if you don't like it,
you're out. Something's going to happen.
A lot of people don't really, they've never worked union. They don't understand how the hall works and explain a little bit about basically how that works. There's contractors out there. There's big companies that hire union members.
Correct.
But those union members, they don't go to the human resources on their own. The companies come to the union, and then you guys assign the jobs. Is that
yes? What happens is they call us. They we sit down first of all. to go over the agreements, what their needs are going to be, things like that. And of course, I went to school for labor law. I went to various schools. I went to Cornell University, took courses, and so I became somewhat aware. I never considered myself an expert at anything, so I don't like it's tough. It's a tough word for me. But anyway, I would sit down with them, or one of us would sit down with them, see what their needs are, what kind of workers they're looking for. We had a legal hiring hall that they had to go through us. And it was supposed to work on the dates you were the last person, the longest unemployed person was supposed to come first. Of course, it never worked that way. The stewards in prime positions would go to the mobsters. We would refer to it slips out the back door.
Yeah,
work
okay.
Slips.
Yeah.
And the rest would, some would go out through the window. That's the regular jobs. The secretary, Jenny D'Angelo, in this particular case, would call them out, and they'd come in, get their slip, and go to work. And they would pay dues, and out of their pay came the benefits. That's where the money was at, always the benefits.
And the benefits.
Not the union dues. The union dues, they pretty much kept stable, didn't touch it, except out of wages. They would take it for wages and expenses, and some of these expenses were voluminous, travel expenses, et cetera. But it was better to travel as a trustee out of the benefit funds because they had much more money. And they would travel always first class, bring their families, their full families, not just a wife or something.
Extended families.
Yeah, which is understandable to bring a wife in a lot of cases.
Yeah.
But not to bring the full family, your cousins and nephews, and stay in the finest hotels.
Expense the meals.
Expense the meals. It didn't matter. They could expense everything out.
So I think people understand the whole kind of labor racketeering right there. That's it in a nutshell right there.
That's correct.
And plus getting kickbacks and no-show jobs and that kind of thing. So you are now this young guy who has an FBI agent friend, and you're saying you got to do something, and they ask you for your help.
Yes,
so that's where we are now. Now,
yes.
How did that help come about? They agreed they wouldn't go after your family.
Yeah. Now, what it started out as we would meet in hotels or just at automobiles. We would drive to certain places. We all would use different names. Even I would a lot of times. Or sometimes I'd even get a phone call at the union hall. Steve Peters is on the line for you. Well, I knew who that was.
Mm-hmm.
Normally, sometimes, like with the CIA, I'd have notes left at my house. But most of the FBI would be through phone calls, and we would meet.
So would you bring him? Like, this is what they're doing. Did he ever, direct you, say, we've got a case going, and can you go into this area, or kind of how, or did you just intelligence?
I was providing raw intelligence.
Okay.
I didn't wear a wire or anything like that in those days. I didn't want to do it. I refused to take pay.
Yeah.
I didn't want to do that because, to me, that would have been wrong. I was getting a pay from the union, and I didn't want to do that. And I did this up until 1989 when I was surfaced. But the Bureau was very good to me after that. I worked under contract. This is where they brought me into the fold. And I worked under contract for quite a few years with the FBI under personal services agreements as a contractor.
Interesting. So you get a kind of heard of this before. And so they would have a case going somewhere.
Yes.
And then they would insert you in. They probably maybe have an informant or somebody that could vouch for you and bring you in.
No, this was past that. By this time, I was known.
You were known?
Yeah. No, we never did that with me. Everything was freelance on my part. When I met with different people, and I do various reports that were eventually turned into 302s. And it's probably it's 3,000 to 6,000. There's so many of them.
Yeah. 302 is a FBI report.
Yeah.
That Ron would tell them, here's what's going on, here's what I'm doing, here's who's who, and here's doing what. And they turn around and write a 302 and say, look what I found out from source number, whatever.
Yeah, that's exactly right.
So how many years then were you in Buffalo running the union? Having the mob tell you what to do, but yet still sending 302s to the FBI.
Well, that would have been from 1973 to 1989.
Wow.
So did they make any cases then?
Yes.
During that time?
Oh, yes.
Labor cases?
Yes, they did. But a lot of it was with other extraneous operations, gambling, killing, murders.
Yeah.
Things of that nature.
So you'd give them tips on this is who this is, this is what's
correct.
Going on. Then they would have other information, other evidence that would come up, and then they'd put it together with what you were telling them.
Right, because at one time we had, a murder happened in Buffalo, one of the labor stewards, this Billy Shalino. And ironically, that day, I had a grievance meeting with an employer. And all of a sudden, all the boys, the Todaros, the Pierres, the Sanzanese, were in the grievance meeting. Now, this is something they never did.
Yeah.
And I'm thinking to myself, boy, this is good. They're finally taking an interest in the union. Little did I know, they're looking to cover their butt.
They want an alibi.
Yeah. this guy was killed, and I happen to know his daughter very well.
Yeah.
We were having some bad problems with Rochester at that time. And he was going to Rochester, but it was for a girlfriend, not to meet with the Rochester faction of the family. And that was why he was killed. Others said he was an informant. He was not an informant.
Yeah.
I know that. I don't know where that came up, but it was probably just an excuse to...
Wait, so was his Rochester girlfriend the wife?
Yeah, he was visiting his girlfriend at Rochester. Pardon me?
Was his girlfriend in Rochester associated with somebody else who
in the mob? No, it wasn't that. It had nothing to do with that, no. I mean, he used to be in my father's crew, but then he was sent over to the Sanzanese crew. They wanted to kill my father at one time, him and this John Camilleri. And then, my father said it was Sammy Frenchmore that saved him. Sammy Pierre told me it was you that saved him because I went to bat. Because I was under Sammy Pierre. I ran with him. That's where I met the Cleveland family. We'd go down and see Jack Licavelli. We went all over. Sammy was a well-respected mobster. Mm-hmm. But no, they wanted to kill him, but it was called off by my father. And Camilleri was killed. The reason for it, a lot of people don't know the answer to this, but I know. It was done because Camilleri and my father went along with Camilleri stupidly. And it was he wanted to join Joe Badano. Joe Badano wanted to move into Western New York because that was his cousin Magadino's territory. But it was never, and Frankie Valente from Rochester had joined in with my father in that. Frankie was close to his Reedy Picoretto. But then when Camilleri was killed, it basically ended.
Hmm.
I remember one time Lauren Picoretto walked into my office, that's 3D's kid, who became that boss later on in Rochester. And Joe Tenera went ballistic. What the F is he doing here?
Mm-hmm.
Well, I happen to know. I grew up with Lauren. You know, we would get together. But I didn't get into it. I said, well, he came to look for it. I don't want that man in this office. He was showing his courage, coming right into the lion's den.
Yeah.
But, I mean, one of the things that I did, as a union official, I also became a trustee for the Laborers International Union. And as a result, I traveled all over with the various families. I got quite close to Accardo in Chicago. I knew him quite well. Vinny Solano was by the go-between, the messenger. All over New York City, I knew a lot of the players, especially the Genoveses. But sub Gambino's, Louie and Larry Giardina, Johnny Riggi and I became close. And as I was saying, even today in my speech here, it hurt me a lot having to testify against him because I liked the guy. It wasn't a homicide case or that. This was a case of theft using a dental fund program that they were involved in. And the same held true with the Buffalo Laborers as well as Cleveland and Newark, New Jersey, well, Elizabeth, New Jersey, Johnny Riggi's area. And he got caught up in it, and that's what I had to attest to. And so, I didn't like putting him in jail.
In Cleveland, you mentioned that at during these years in the 70s, that's when the famous Kill the Irishman, what was his name?
Battle of what's going on.
All of a sudden I've lost his name, Green.
Danny Green.
Danny Green thing was going on. He was in it. He was involved in the labor union.
I don't think it was the laborers, but it was another union.
It wasn't the laborers. I think it was a dock workers dock union workers. Of some kind.
Yeah.
So he was throwing up against the family there. So you had some connection to that, didn't you?
Oh, yeah. I was down there at that time. We had bodyguards with us at all times. We went to see Leo Mocheri in the hospital.
Because they had a heck of a mob war going on during that time.
Leo Mocheri was in the hospital, so Sammy Pierre and I, with our driver, of course, who waited outside the door, and the other individual, I can't recall the names on the driver and the bodyguards.
Yeah.
One waited by the vehicle, and the other one came into the hospital with us. We went and see Leo the Lips. I didn't know him by the Lips back then. I just knew him as Leo Mocheri. After that, we went to dinner with Jack Licavelli. They drove us over to dinner with Jack White. May She Rockman cape in. May She did wear that cowboy string tie, by the way.
Yeah, he did didn't that. He?
Yep.
Now, a little aside on May She Rockman. He was a guy who Nick Civella would call and coordinate with to get the Stardust skim money. And Nick would know that it came into Chicago because his nephew, Anthony Schiavola, lived in Chicago, and he was doing some of the currying back and forth. And then May She Rockman would drive up from Cleveland and meet Anthony Schiavola, who was a Chicago police officer, actually, and take their cut back. Small world in that.
Yeah, I know.
Everybody knows everybody, and you were right in among them.
I was in a snowplow business at the time. I had set up a snowplow. It's one of the legal areas I could go into without violating what we refer to as Lanham-Griffith, Labor Management Recording and Disclosure Act. And I ended up getting in the snowplow business. So one of the projects that we had to get approved was the Eastern Hills Mall, which was owned by Eddie DiBartolo, the builder. Well, Eddie DiBartolo comes out of Youngstown. He's controlled in many, many ways by OC. And we had to get the approval. And it was approved. Then I went down and see Eddie DiBartolo. Well, let me finish the other story.
Okay.
We're at the table. May She Rockman's there. Later on, we meet up with Tony Libert, Carmen Carpinteri from the Carpinelli. So I may have it wrong. He's with the electricians. Later on, we went to another restaurant where Tony Libertori came in, who I happen to know, Tony. Jack White was limping at that time. I didn't remember he had to use a cane. Jackie Presser walks in. And I'm telling you, he's supposed to be a labor leader. He knew nothing about labor law, nothing about workers' rights. They wanted me to go with the Teamsters.
Oh, really?
Yeah. Jack White wanted me to go with the Teamsters Union and participate, help them out a little bit. The problem that we had back then is Joe Todaro was the boss, and he would never, ever let me go. He wanted me with the laborers. I was their front man, so to speak, legitimacy. But I'm talking to Presser, and he didn't know anything. You know, this man, but I seen that same thing, same hold true with Angelo Fosco at the laborers. I mean, these people did not know anything whatsoever about workers' rights or whatnot. But after we left Cleveland, we went back, Sebi Pieri and I went back to Buffalo, and then I received a call from Gus Regas, Marvin something, and I was to meet with Gus Regas down at Youngstown, Ohio, on Market Street with the DiBartolo Company. I went down there, and the deal was cut already. You know, they agreed. We had an agreement, and we were still plowing it. That's how it started. But it also caused me major problems.
Wait, is there like a snowplow union?
No, there was no snowplow union. We did use union people, and we always paid the right rates. But I didn't realize that by doing that, as much as I knew the mob, I didn't think they'd want it all. Well, I had a partner, Nicky DiMaggio. Nicky DiMaggio is Sammy Carlisi's nephew, him and Roy's nephew. And he was part of it, him and his brother Dominic and Joey. But it was Nicky that was part of it. But they were hard workers. I have to say that. They were good workers. I would never knock up for that.
Well, whether they were in the mob or not,
they were not in the mob at that time. Later on, I understood Nicky DiMaggio joined the Chicago family. They went back to Chicago. But at this time, they came into Buffalo. They were living in Buffalo, and they were under Roy's protection. And I had to bring them in. Well, when it came time to cut up the money, little did I know that Sammy Pieri wanted 50% and that DiMaggio's wanted 50%. And then
there's a lot of snow shoveling.
Yeah, but they don't look at taxes. They don't look at wages. They just see that gross amount. Yeah. And they want 50% of that. You tell them there's such a thing called taxes.
And you can't 1099 that out, so you can deduct it either, can you?
They don't care. They don't want to see that. They just want 50% of that gross amount. And actually, I became quite large because I did the Blizzard in Buffalo, a good portion of it for the Army Corps, and eventually I did Chicago. I went into Chicago. Well, next we did Rhode Island. We were working out of the governor's office, and then we went to Chicago during the Blizzard. And Pete Chevarilli, who was with Streets, brought me in. Finally, it's funny what happened was in Chicago.
So the outfit made sure you got a good contract with the city. Well,
they didn't even know I had it. No, they didn't know until later.
How'd you get it?
I did it on my own.
Didn't they have
control? We called up. Naturally from Buffalo. We know how to move snow.
Yeah.
And that's the thing. We had to bring equipment from all over the country. and we showed him how to remove snow properly. It's funny, but then Pete Chavarelli and I started talking, and it seems we had friends in common. Pete was the manager for the group singing group Chicago. He also
Where I've heard that name before.
He was a Notre Dame graduate, and he was very, very close. He was working streets and sanitation, but he was close to the mob.
Yeah.
He had a lot of connections. And we started talking. We had a lot of connections in common. And Chicago never asked for any money, but they asked for my help on how to remove snow so they could bring their contractors in.
Yeah.
And I sat down with the everyone, including Bear Belandic, about how to do these things. My recommendation is that you bring the Army Corps in, let them be responsible. Today, it's God's problem. Tomorrow, it's your problem that the streets aren't clean. Bring the Army Corps in. They have much more ability and assets to assist in cleaning the streets properly. Donovan, who was the assistant to Belanda, came back and told me that, no, we'll clean it up ourselves. The only way reason you would do that is because of money. And we were out there cleaning, and within a couple of years, you're making $500,000. Well, you're doing $500,000 gross work.
Mm-hmm.
The problem is, again, you have what Davis-Bacon rates, so you're paying the union scale for operating engineers and truck drivers because of the fact that this is equipment you honor. Plus, of course, taxes, everything that goes with it, meals we have to pick up. And the same thing held true there. Everybody wants, this guy wants his 50%, this guy wants his 50%. Mm-hmm. And I can't argue, no matter what I say, that they don't care. They want their 50% each. And I wrote about that in my story. I mean,
how can you got to pay the people. You, like you say, you have equipment, fuel, expenses.
Yeah.
How do you give the taxes? How do you give all the 100%
that's how they
of
are.
The
they try to own you.
Operate a business.
Yeah, they own you. Now, this is all being recorded at the time. You know, with the Bureau.
Because this was during 72 to 89.
Yeah, but this was during, like, for example, the blizzard of 75, 76 in Buffalo, 77, 78 in New England, and 79 in Chicago. You know, that's when we were over there. In Chicago, they were driving these blue dump trucks up and down, garbage trucks up and down the street to make ruts instead of moving it. They didn't know how to move it.
I think I remember seeing that on television.
Yeah. We had the chair wars. That people would clean out in front of their house and they'd put a chair there so that some sites would say landmines. Don't go near it.
So the Bureau's, they're working a case on this all along for the corruption, the racketeering case on these guys.
Yeah, that was going on. One of the things we had, there was a racketeering case going on in Florida involving Accardo, Santo Traficante, the Coyas from the Laborers International, and a few others. Terry O'Sullivan, his son's now the president. He was the one that put this deal together. Irv Davidson, do you remember him?
I don't remember that name.
Irving Davidson. And who was the informant again? I can't think of his name. There was an informant on the case. And I went to listen to him out in California. And I decided not to meet him. Or the state of Washington, excuse me. And I can't think of his name offhand, but he was a source. And they had this charge with the different medical programs, teeth, dental, things like that, going on all over the country. Florida, all over. Chicago. Well, the feds building a case. I'm down in Florida when they're paying a couple of Santo Traficante's boys money to take the fall. You had Sal Tricario and this Johnny, and I think his last name was Eppolito. They were paying him off. And Arthur Coy said, see, I'm the one that do that. The money didn't come from Angelo Fosco. It came from me. And then they also established funds so that they could get their legal bills paid for. We had a legal program.
Now,
that was a way that they could skim more money?
That's correct. Well, they wanted to take care of them. They're taking the fall because you had Santo online, Santo Traficante. You have Accardo, which you didn't want to take a fall. This guy's never been caught before. Now what are you going to do?
Yeah.
The Foscos were caught up with it in Coya. And this Terry O'Sullivan is an insurance scam.
It was an insurance scam. But that's a different from the snow.
This is totally different.
Tell us a little bit about the benefits. How did the mob? How did they? I know they're always interested in getting these benefit packages going. Mm-hmm. How did that was lucrative thing for them.
Oh, very little.
So how did they do that? What were the nuts and bolts of that?
One of the big areas was what we call churning, where you're buying and selling constantly, and you have a piece of the broker. That way, the broker's making more money, and they're kicking back to you.
Okay.
Another way is what they would do is it could be any penny stock. You could take any stock, or any stock for that matter. Go invest your own money via a cousin or a friend into that particular stock. Then they would get the unions, the various union pension funds around it, the controlled ones, to pump up that stock. They'd pump it up, and of course, then you take your money. You make your profits, you get out, then they're stuck with the loser. The members are stuck with the loser. The individuals make a lot of money.
What about the union? They put money in.
Well, that's what I'm saying. The pension fund, yeah.
The pension fund.
That's what I'm talking about. The workers, yeah, they lose it. But in the meantime, they got they're making quadruple their money or whatever amounts. Yeah. I mean, it's unbelievable. It's what you could make in some of that, millions upon millions of dollars.
Yeah, I'd go buy a stock. Then because I know the labor union, the pension fund, is going to go make a large purchase that stock. When they make that large purchase, it drives the price up, and then sell.
That's correct.
Then it's going to drop back down because it wasn't that good a stock anyhow.
Correct.
So there was another thing about kickbacks from doctors. I know in Kansas City we had a dental program going with the Teamsters, and this there was this real shady dentist that was involved with that. How did that work?
Same way. We had the Jesse Hyman case. Jesse actually thought he was kicking back to me. Now, one time I'm in the vehicle, and I have Danny Sanzanese and this Angela Massaro, and I had a problem because they said they pushed, I can't recall, it was $5,000, something like that. I think it was $5,000 that I had to give to split with my father. Now, I want to tell my father, I gave it to the government, Al Hartle, who was with the organized crime stripe, because I can't take the money.
So, yeah, that's a good question people would have. Is if you made some money off of some illegal deal, then you didn't keep the money.
Oh, no.
You reported it to the bureau, but they made you give them the money too.
Yes, that's correct.
Bastards.
Well, I know, but I had I had no choice. I'm not going to get caught up
teasing,
in something.
Yeah.
Well, you couldn't tell the folks that were these mobsters.
Oh no, I couldn't do that. I'd blow my cover. Money. What am I going to say? I'm not going to take it.
Yeah.
That's like my father. He says, "Don't." I did let him know on these things. He says, "Don't worry about it."
So we got off the doctors a little bit there. I know we had a whole hospital run by a doctor in Kansas City that all of a sudden the Teamsters had a big contract with them, and it was always suspected that he was, he had to kick back to get that contract.
Well, that's like with us. We had the same thing. We had, like we're talking about, what caught up Johnny Riggi with the dental fund. These were all insurance scams. Doctors would be up front. They would have the Buffalo Health, Buffalo Dental Program. Of course, it was a scam. It's Jesse Hyman's running it, and they're making all kinds of money and kicking back to the mob. And the same thing held true in Cleveland with Tony Liberatore and his brother Chester, different locals, and in Jersey with Johnny Riggi, who, I was always asked about him, about The Sopranos because of him. But I said, I never watched it. And that's the truth. I never watched it.
You should. It's from real life.
I mean, there's a few I watched. I'm just not into that. It's like a spy movie.
Yeah.
I didn't watch them.
I think in Kansas City, we talked a little bit about the doctors. And wouldn't the mob basically come in and strong-arm the doctor so that he had to give them money as well?
Well, if he wanted a contract.
Yeah, if he wanted
a contract, they had to pay him.
He had to kick back.
Yeah, if the doctor didn't come to them, then no, they're not going to bother him. But if a doctor goes to the union for help or to the mobster for help, then they own him.
Yeah.
Now they're going to hit him. We had. I remember one time I was going through my bills or my benefit funds because I had access to it. I was a trustee in the benefit funds, and I'm going through my records, and I seen glasses being charged to me.
Yeah.
I never purchased glasses. I didn't wear glasses.
Oh, I see. Interesting.
So that's what they would do. There were things like that. They had a lot of schemes going.
See, you see these terms in the paper, labor racketeering, and they had some scam with a benefit fund. You never understand, what does that really mean? Well, you understand what it really means.
Oh, yeah.
You know that's how it works, and I think that's really fascinating how it works.
Yeah, there's so many easy ways that they can do it, and they've always been pretty good at covering their tracks, so it's very difficult to get at them.
Yeah.
You really would have to examine all the books, and then the lawyers are going to tie up the Justice Department in court with the rights, what they could see, what they can't see, what's privileged material, what isn't privileged material, and that made it a problem.
Does
the FBI have access to your medical records?
Yeah.
Just something like that.
Exactly.
So,
good point.
Yeah.
When you spoke this morning, if at the Mob World Summit, you basically said this is kind of where they're at now. with the medical.
Medical. Yeah. Medicare.
Well, that's big. That's big
Medicaid
today.
Fraud.
Oh, yeah. It's very big today. What they do is they actually make software for the hospitals and insurance companies. And it's all over. It's that big. I mean, you have Johns Hopkins, I believe, was on the list. A number of others. I can't recall the full list, but there was quite a few of them. And they made the software. And with that software, they have access, of course. They develop into the program access where they can themselves can get into the billing, things of that nature, medical records if needed. But most of the time it dealt with the billing or deals with the billing. This way, their contractors could go in and so get the right price. They know the prices. When you know the prices, it's easy to manipulate.
It's kind of like in Vegas, they would misweight the scale so that when they weighed it, they knew that they were able to pull off a certain amount.
Correct.
Actually a hard count of it. And in this instance, they would rig the software.
Correct. Oh, it's rigged.
You wouldn't think that, I know. You know, everyone always thinks of the mob as these tough Goombas that don't know anything. But every time we talk to folks, you know, Ronald, when we talked with, you know, Frank Culotta and, you know, Frank Calabrese Jr., these guys are really smart guys.
Oh, you have a lot
and
of smart
they could have been real businessmen.
No question about it. Some of them are highly intelligent. There's a lot of goons.
Yeah, there's always a goon.
Yeah, there's a lot of the
money makers are the smart guys.
The smart guys, yeah. They know how to do
really
it.
Really make money.
See, like, so Gary knows, like, I didn't grow up in a union state. I grew up in South Dakota, and so I don't even really know what a trustee is.
I think
Gary's a trustee of the police pension fund.
Yeah.
I know what that is interesting. We have over $1 billion in that fund, Ron.
No kidding, huh?
And I think this is what they used to do. The trustees used to sit around, and when you own three or four of them, you'd say, okay, we're going to loan this nice young guy $60 million to go buy some casinos because he can make money for us. And everybody said, okay, and rubber stamp it and ship the money off without thinking about, you know, who was going to get screwed over if this guy, because it was barely secured. It was really basically on the guy's name. There was not really any decent security.
That happens all the time with the unions. I mean, that was happening. I was actually the chairman of the Western New York Building Trades Investment Foundation, and we were to invest in contracts. We did the Hyatt Hotel. We did a number of places where because there's a good return, plus you guarantee it's union.
Yeah.
That's always good.
Guarantee union jobs with your money. Yeah,
right.
That's interesting.
And at first, they were a little upset with me, the Bob. You know, you need our permission for these things, Ronnie. You acted on your own. Within weeks, they came back and said, we like that idea, what you've done. Now we're going to run it for you. And they made sure that their contractors were taken care of.
Yeah,
and
then they get a kickback. Yeah,
I remember this one hotel. It's a strongly connected hotel near the airport, and it's supposed to go union. And we had to give the guy money. I go out there, it's all non-union. not all of it, but a good portion of the blacktop's being done non-union. You can't do this. It's our money. Just leave it alone, Ronnie. In other words, they're cheating.
Interesting.
Yeah. It was mob connected. All the money was starting to go to mob connected people. And the problem was, it's not just our union. I have the electricians, I have the iron workers, I have all these trades involved. And you try to, buy good ideas. Might as well throw them out the window because the mob would latch onto them and just try to milk them. You can't do that. I remember Jack Kemp, the former congressman, came to me. He was the one that originally came to me on the Hyatt Hotel and wanted us to invest in it. And I told him, I'll look at it, but of course I have to get it approved with the employer. Because both sides, you have the employer and the union representing the funds. And I had to sit down with this entrepreneur, who was a very nice guy, by the way. And at first we had set it up totally legitimate. And it was. I mean, everything done on that particular project was A-okay. There was no kickbacks or that. The only thing I didn't like is Phil Schwab ended up with the demolition. Now, if anybody's been in the demolition business in this country, they will know the name Phil Schwab. He was the number one demolition contractor for the mob. It could have been the Lauderdale Airport, Yankee Stadium, Trump Towers.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
And he did the demolition in Manhattan.
Well, and the Trump Towers, he used a company called Kasachi & Sons to do the demolition. He didn't do it himself because he was having problems. But he was all over the country, Detroit, Strohsbury. I could go on and on. And more people got killed and abused and hazardous waste and toxic waste with this guy. The guy was just ruthless.
Yeah, there's a whole other can of worms there, is the mob involved in disposing of hazardous waste. Yeah. I shudder to think what they've done.
Well, I was originally given permission to go after the guy because he wasn't kicking back to the Toderos.
Yeah.
He was, at that time, kicking back to others. So Todaro said, you could go after him. Well, I started going after him big time, but I had the government involved. And then he said, I had the Coast Guard because he was loading the ships with PCBs, phenols, and dioxins. They're shipping it overseas, or you know, they dump a lot of that stuff in the ocean, the liquids, and the steel would go overseas. And I had the Coast Guard involved, everybody, EPA and all that. I ended up getting a call from Todaro. You better see me. What the F did you do? I have Wisconsin. I have the Chicago laborers going after him. You know the problem you caused. You know, he had to go to a sit-down over. You caused a major problem here. This guy, I said, go after him. I didn't mean to use the Navy. He called the Coast Guard the Navy.
Maybe he, his fingers or something.
Yeah, I'll tell you another funny story that I did. We were having a big problem, a fight between the Pierres and the Todaros in Western New York. And we had to cut up their areas, different segments of the community, where they could represent the jobs, take care of it. And the Pierres were not that familiar with the Southern Tier, which includes the Seneca Nations of Indians. And they go down there, and there's a job, and they start putting their own people on. Well, Calvin Lay, the president of the Seneca Nations, and a dear friend of mine, calls me up. What's going on, Ron? The jobs on the reservation always went to the American Indians. And I says, yes, you're right. He says, well, they're down here, and they're telling us we can't get on the job. I says, Calvin, meet me at a certain place. Let's talk. I told him, come down to the Union Hall and scream and demand to see the Pierres. They came down, three car loads, and they had it was like, it wasn't a convertible. One was a car with
it's like something out of a movie.
Yeah, they cut the top off. They cut the hard
top off.
Yeah, they waited there, and they demanded to see the Pierres. The two, Joe and John Pierre, stayed the back. And little did I know, they were so afraid they spent the evening there. Their father goes and sees Tony Salerno. This is actually in the commission case. His father goes, Joe Pierre goes down and sees Tony Salerno and complains about what I did. And that this was a Todaro who was connected to the Gambinos, that faction.
In fact, Tony Salerno was telling people what his connection was.
Yeah, I mean, a lot of people thought he was the head of the Genovese family. There is no one, I mean, to me at least.
He was more like the guy they fronted for a while.
Yeah, the Genovese families are very, it's funny how it operates. They've always been the most powerful, by the way.
But they stayed low.
They stayed low profile. Yeah. And he goes down and complains. And the next thing, I'm down in Florida with Joe Todaro Sr. We're going to a restaurant, and Louis Giardina from the Gambino family was with us. Joe Todaro says, Roddy, come here, I got to talk to you. Did you sick the Indians and the Pierres? I said, I did, yeah. He said, oh, you caused me a problem. Don't worry, I'll take care of it. I sicked the Indians. I did.
Well, but the Indians end up getting the jobs then?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, they were. I mean, you know, I was what they, I wouldn't say an honorary chief. They told me I was an honorary. I didn't go through no ceremony, but they were always strong supporters of it. These guys were great workers.
You got a good line of credit at their casino now, probably.
Yeah, but I mean, they're great workers. That was
their
territory.
It was iron work. American Indians are the best.
Yeah.
They are the best.
Yep. But moving on. Once I surfaced. After it was done by a U.S. attorney, actually. A U.S. attorney leaked the information about me. We're not positive, but we're 95% sure he's the one that leaked it. Because everything changed once he became the U.S. attorney. Dennis Vacco in New York State. For the Western New York, eventually became attorney general for New York State. And we were having a hard time with the FBI and this guy. This guy here did not like the FBI. He went after them, and people don't realize, they're always blaming the FBI for doing things. You have to realize the FBI answers to the DOJ.
Which is the Department of Justice.
That's the way it's supposed to. I mean, that's why I can't understand how could Comey possibly act on his own in that case. I just don't understand that.
He shouldn't have.
That doesn't work that way. You're supposed to answer, no matter who's politically motivated or what. I don't want to get into that. But I know how the FBI operates.
And the strike force, those U.S. attorneys, especially the strike force attorneys, are aggressive.
Yeah.
I know I had a situation where I had an informant who was pretty well placed and was not really a key witness, but this U.S. attorney decided that she was.
Yeah.
He said, she's got to testify. I said, man, I promised her she would never have to testify. Oh, she's got it. She's going to have to testify, at least in the grand jury. She's got to. And, you know, she did.
And that's, yeah, you blow their cover. I mean, that's you got to be very careful.
They'll do it in a split second to make their case.
Yeah, they'll do that. I've seen that.
Did you wonder why this guy outed you?
He was connected. I know he got his job. It was a number. Al D'Amato appointed him. And the people that went to Al D'Amato, one graduated from high school for me. He ran for governor of New York State, Carol Palladino. He was an associate of his. Russ Gugino was under Jack Kemp. Jack Kemp wasn't involved in this. He may have been. I don't know what year he died. I think he was elected because I testified in front of Congress and I bumped into Jack once. But Russ Gugino, other party people from that group that are involved with the mob were the ones that told D'Amato, Al D'Amato, the senator, to appoint Dennis Vacco. And no sooner did he come in, we had problems.
Well, and it was one of those situations where they were unaware of this ongoing work that you were doing for the FBI.
Well, he never knew.
They never knew until he knew
something because they had to let him know that I was cooperating by law.
It's really they had to do Ronald that, which is crazy. Ghost card.
And I was very upset. We went to Pittsburgh, and we had a meeting there, the FBI and I, and I was very upset over this. Very upset. Now, you're blowing me out of the water, basically. And that happened. I have it on audio tape. The FBI or the organized crime saying it's not coming from us. It's coming from there, meaning the federal building. So we knew where it came from.
From the regular U.S. attorneys.
Yeah.
U.S. attorneys.
Yeah.
Okay.
So that blew me out of the water. I had to leave. I left. But the FBI stood right there with me. They told me, you're going right on the payroll. And they did. We reached a personal services agreement that allowed me to go where I wanted to go. I had to be careful.
Yeah.
You know, I had to be careful because there's a price tag on my head. But we always had a good I always had a good relationship with them. I mean, they were always gentlemen, fine ladies that I worked with.
You even ended up working at Quantico.
I was
teaching
an
undercover school. And
I taught language classes once.
Oh, well, for your Russian?
Yeah, well, not for that. I just had to talk to the Russian interpreters.
Okay.
They already had a lot of Russian people there
working. That's what I would have thought. We want to get into that Russian CIA thing in a minute. But talk a little bit about working at Quantico.
I would go in and talk about court preparation quite a lot.
Oh, okay.
Prepare. One of the things I did talk about were the reporting, that to keep it simple, you don't want to overblow your reports because then you have to back that up. You're only giving somebody more ammunition to beat up the person that's taking the stand, if they take the stand, and how to prepare for court and how to prepare witnesses for court. One of the problems we always had in the system is the more you give us, the better deal you're going to get. And it's not coming from the Bureau. It was coming from the DOJ's office, the Justice Department, and the Assistant United States Attorney. They're hungry. And it's not all. We've got a lot of decent people. I mean, I've worked with Bob Stewart, one of the greatest strike force attorneys that I've ever worked with. But I had some that were very highly aggressive. Ann Rowland's out here. Mitchell Mars in Chicago was great. Working with them, I like those guys because keep it to the truth. Mm-hmm. Others, well, of course, with me it was different because I didn't have to hide anything. But I've seen Assistant United States Attorneys tell these guys to cut a deal, and I've seen it in Buffalo. We want more. We want more. And I've seen it elsewhere. We want more. That's not good enough. You want the deal that you're looking for, you're going to have to give us more. And you know what happens when you have to give them more?
They make it up.
They make it up.
Yes.
Yeah.
They figure out what you want, and then they feed it to you. I've had informants do that to me. They figure out what I want, and then they start feeding it to me.
Right. And now you're dealing with an illusion instead of reality.
Yeah.
Well, and how does that hold up in court?
Carry it out. Some are good salesmen.
Sometimes it does. It's just like that. We interviewed these two FBI agents who, there was an FBI agent from named Paul Rico from Boston, and Steve Fleming.
Steve the Rifleman Fleming.
The Rifleman Steve Fleming, and another guy said that they actually killed this guy down in Oklahoma who had a highlight operation, and somebody else wanted him killed, and they did the killing, and they told a U.S. attorney that wanted to make a case that this FBI agent actually gave them the location and the little bit of the like what the guy normally did, the country club he played golf at. They went down this country club and laid in wait for him and killed him. He ended up convicting this FBI agent based on these two guys were alone, and they both were looking at that. They had a case on them in Oklahoma, and they were looking at the death penalty in Oklahoma, and they bargained their way out of the Oklahoma case altogether by giving up this FBI agent. And these two guys went back, retired agents, and they went back and looked at this case from one end to the other, and they said, you know, and the FBI agent Rico died of natural causes during this process, but they said, you know, that was all just bullshit. That was a lie. So that kind of stuff happens.
Yeah, sometimes you have to wear the weight, you know, you put the tall boots on when you go into this stuff. But someday when we have a lot of time, I'll talk about Kansas. Rose Chemical. You ever hear of Rose Chemical?
I haven't.
Check into it.
Okay.
That was a mob operation. There was a lot of illegal dumping that took place there.
Of chemical waste. And,
some of the same players that are now in the healthcare business.
Okay. I'll look into that.
Well, but with the Paul Rico case, there was, I mean, you and he say he died of natural causes. He died handcuffed to a hospital bed.
Yeah,
and they messed up his medication. They were changing out this heart medication, and they killed him. And then I thought, wasn't it when we talked with the guys about the case that wrote the book that they basically said all they had on Paul Rico was like a little slip of paper with a phone number.
They didn't even have that paper. All they had was a word of Steve Fleming, other guy, who said he wrote this name and address on a piece of paper.
I lived up in that area for a while, up at Newburyport, Mass. So I knew some of the family of Fleming and a few of the others. But we used to go to Camille's in Providence, Rhode Island, and that was the Patriarcha hangout. We would go there sometimes. But all over. I mean, it would be different mobsters. If you're down in Florida, we'd go to Joe Zonkin's in Hollywood. That was a Chicago hangout.
Interesting.
Yeah.
So let's go on to the CIA. Okay. I'm really interested in this.
Yeah.
So how did that come about?
Well, I was working Russia. It started with the Bureau. I was working Russia.
So you're working foreign counterintelligence for the foreign counterintelligence.
Well, actually, I was working Russian Mafia. Bureau. I'm doing Russian Mafia, but I knew a lot of the political officials in Russia. I was close to the former deputy foreign minister, Alexander Orlov, Andrei Vavida, who was a speechwriter for Putin, and connected. And I was close to quite a few people. But I also had worked my way in where I was close to some of the mobsters. And we go to clubs. One club, I mean, the drinks were literally $150 a drink. Of course, we didn't have to pay. But you did see a lot of American politicians, things like that in there. Near the statue of Yuri Dolgoruki. But you could.
This was in Russia.
This was in Moscow, yeah.
Okay.
In those days, I was using code name Gorky.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
That's a good one.
Yeah. Then I eventually got involved. I mean, there was a lot of work I did. I eventually got involved in the case of the spy swap.
Yeah. What was that?
That was, I knew Anna Chapman.
So what? But who was she?
Anna Chapman was the redhead, the pretty redhead that was operating in New York. Now, I didn't know her at that time. Previously, I knew her in London. I was selling alcohol, liquor products from Belarus, from Minsk, and she was going to import them into London and the UK. So I met her in London, and little did I know that, you know, I'm not looking at her. She's looking at me to find out what I'm doing.
Yeah.
Because I knew.
Your cover then? Liquor distributor out of Russia, out of Belarus.
Yeah. And, I mean, we're walking around town. She's trying to grab my hand, which is fine. I don't mind grabbing my hand. But, you know, I was smart enough never to let somebody go too far with me because you're being set up. But we did go to her house, and it was kind of surprising that there was an old man sitting near the door. Didn't say anything. And he must have been her handler, I'm assuming. But later on, Gennady gets as a result, once she surfaced as a spy in the United States, they picked up Gennady Vasilenko. Gennady Vasilenko was a former KGB colonel. And he was in the United States, and he's trying to flip one of my dear friends, Jack Platt, who was a CIA officer. Well, Jack's doing the same with him. But they had a problem. They liked to drink.
Mm-hmm.
And as a result, they'd be out a lot. When Hansen, the FBI agent, Hansen went south on us and started selling secrets to the Russians, he said that Gennady was cooperating with the CIA. And in those days, he was not. But, of course, now they had him arrested, and they shipped him back to Moscow. And he was charged with having 22 caliber bullets, and he was using dynamite to blow holes in ice. And they had to have a charge against
him. So they made a charge up.
They made a charge up.
And popped him when he was in back in Russia.
Right.
On Hansen's word.
Yep. And that's correct.
And then the United States, the FBI ends up arresting this.
They arrested nine of them. I believe there was a number of them here that were transferred back.
Several of them.
Yeah, we took a few back. But on Gennady,
they're going to trade her for Gennady.
Yeah. So now, but before that, well, Gennady's in jail. Before we get into that, Gennady's in jail. He got picked up for being a spy under Hansen's word. I go over to Moscow and I meet with Orlov, the deputy foreign minister, my druk, which means my friend in Russian, and I also meet with a number of other people, and I explain to him, listen, the guy's innocent. I'm not going to tell you that, you could take my word for it, because they knew my background. You know, they're not stupid. Don't ever think that they're stupid. If you're going to do something, you better stay as close to the truth as possible, because don't overestimate yourself and never underestimate the adversary. And I told him that this was, this is just a setup by this guy. He didn't know. Well, I got him transferred to a community in Smolensk. Well, I helped to get him transferred. I don't know if any other people assisted me, but we got him transferred to a community in Smolensk where he could walk around and get around while we're waiting for things to change. In the meantime, his son is contacted, and I'll give you the name. Now, this comes from actually an Al-Qaeda link. His son is contacted by this guy, Timur. And the person that he was dealing with was a Fadi Darwish, who was a Lebanese. He was affiliated originally with Hezbollah al-Ansar, a terrorist group that was affiliated with Al-Qaeda. And he came there to purchase weapons. He came to Belarus.
Yeah.
but the weapons were taken
by
others. And so he couldn't purchase weapons out of Belarus. Wesley Mihalchuk and a few others that were in the arms business had control of what's going on in Belarus. So he went to Russia, and he developed relations with this Timur, and I don't want to give his last name, but they developed relations. Well, we find out that they go to Gennady's side to tell him he can get out of jail if they give him $5,000. And they took the $5,000 without, of course they're not getting him out of jail. We learned about that. They ripped the kid off. But anyway, finally we worked on it, and we got Gennady out of jail. And we had him transfer here once we had the spy swap. But getting back to what happened, he got caught with a cell phone while he's in Smolensk. I'm told, get out of his back, do it hard time. I go back this time, no one would meet with me. The relationship had soured. And I did talk to a few people. But they said there's nothing they could do. Now that's when the spy swap eventually took place, and we brought Gennady to the U.S.
And the spy swap was this Chapman, and there were several. There were several.
Yeah, there were several of them, and they were really
got popped all around in the East Coast.
New York City and places like that.
They've been people that had been sent over years before and kind of assimilated into the society.
Well, you still have them. You have a lot
still
of them.
Still have them.
Oh, yeah, they're all over.
They did a TV show on that's called The Americans. But this was the original kind of when they first found some people and then did a swap for.
Right. You have a major problem in this country with the Russian mafia. They're all over. I would go around and give speeches about the Russian mafia and their ties. They're very, very powerful, and they're highly, highly intelligent. It could be anything from smuggling coming in from Mexico or sometimes just a simple money laundering job.
Yeah.
But they're big. They're that powerful, and they stay under the radar. A lot of them like to have automobile dealerships or things of that nature, so they have a legitimate business to filter the money.
Yeah, we've got one. It's got a limo service.
Yeah, well, they have that.
Which is pretty handy.
Track suits.
Take people back and forth from the airport, and you just got these legitimate reasons to move around town.
Yeah, I had a couple cases, which I can't talk about because they've never surfaced. But I knew that the bureau had enough that they could have easily popped them because I wore a sport coat with a button on it, and I knew where the bug was, and I knew where the camera was.
It was a camera in your butt.
And I'm looking at
and
it
a microphone.
Closely, and I can't see it, and I cannot see it.
That's.
That was amazing. But when I see the final production, it was great. But that case never came to light.
1080i.
Yeah, that case never came to light. So that tells me that they flipped somebody.
Yeah.
Or
they're still using them.
Still working on a larger case.
Yeah.
It's those long-term deals, it was always frustrating for me as a policeman with the FBI. And it's even worse with the CIA, I understand, that they want to work these long-term deals in which your people, a lot of people are getting away with a lot of stuff, and you see it, but they won't do anything about it because they got this long view of it. So
yeah, I mean, it's difficult. You have your arguments. I know one case agent I had an argument with. He told me, you have to keep everything illegal. And I said, I have to keep everything illegal. Now, I know I have a big mouth, and I know it's hard to do a transcript after listening to me talk about the weather, the sky is blue, filling in all these words. But if I kept it illegal, the flags would be up all over the place. These people are not stupid. That would bury you so fast. That's when you get clipped.
Yeah.
Well, I was just curious. The Russian mafia, obviously, they started in Russia. Did they kind of come over to the U.S. and other countries in the world because it was easier to operate?
It's a combination. There's so many different various reasons. It's new sources of income. Mm. I mean, they could operate freely in Russia. I shouldn't say freely. It depends how much you kick back to various governmental officials. Over there, shroft. That means graft. That's a way of life. You do not deal business in Russia without shroft. For example, if you're building a hotel over there or anything,
You figured that in back. The overhead.
Some of the things we did, we used a lot of our taxpayer money that went to the Russian mafia, which was wrong. They're building over there, and they're kicking back to the mob, so we helped build them.
Huh,
we're trying to build Russia. I mean, there were things I didn't like. I mean, I remember during the Bill Clinton administration, the Russians during that time previous welcomed us with open arms.
I remember that. There were businessmen flying over there like crazy because there was opportunity.
Yeah, and then all of a sudden what happened is the people themselves couldn't understand. We're taking in Poland, we're taking in Latvia, we're taking in all the former Soviet countries into NATO. Why aren't they joining? So it was our recommendation to bring them into NATO. It's better to have them inside working with you.
Yeah.
Otherwise, you're going to cause animosity with the population. That's what happened. We caused the animosity. When Putin was appointed, it was actually Boris Berezovsky that wanted Putin. They had a meeting in what's called the Sparrow Hill Club, and you had Abramowitz, Peter Avid from Alpha Bank, Boris the Builder, and they were there. And Putin was put in, not that he was to be successful, he was put in because they wanted him to fail. The Chechen War was going on, and they figured he'll take a flop. They were that sure that he'd take a flop instead of being successful, and it changed. I remember I was talking to the commander. I was a good dear friend of the commander of the Russian army in Chechnya, Gennady Troshev. He says, Ronnie, how do I fight a fight where my enemies got better weapons than me? And they're coming out of my own country.
Yeah.
You know, we're talking to Russian. It was funny because I told him, speak Russian. Your English is lousy. Then he told me, speak English. Your Russian is lousy. And we were both drunk. And we both, I would say drunk, but, tipsy.
Yeah.
He got kicked out by Putin, and he was sent to head up the Cossacks. But he was a nice guy, good general.
And,
we were developing relationships, and it's smart. You know what when it comes to spying, we've been doing it on them, and they've been doing it on us for hundreds of years, or at least 100 years.
Yeah.
Since 1917, anyway. So, that's an ongoing thing.
It's all in the game. Yeah. So what are you doing now, Ron?
I'm a private detective.
Private detective.
Yeah, I'm a private detective. I do a lot of state cases. I work for the Commonwealth of Virginia.
Oh, okay.
And usually it's criminal.
Yeah.
And I try to find out
the attorney truth. General or?
Well, they work. Usually I'm appointed by the judge in various cases.
Oh, I see. Okay.
If a client has a public defender, the public defender has the right to ask for outside assistance.
Oh, yeah, yeah,
but I have
to
be approved by the judge. It all has to be approved.
And who pays for that, the state?
The state, And you're surprised at the innocent people you get off. Not all, but...
I worked with them. When I was in law school, I worked with the public defender. And what I did, basically, they had a couple of private investigators working for them, and they just used me as an investigator. Yeah. And the first case I got into was a classic case of over prosecution and having the wrong person also, and they ended up. I worked it up, and I went to the prosecutor. I said, "I used to be a policeman, and you got the wrong person here. This is who you need to go after." And he laughed at me. And you know what? We went to trial. They had a full jury trial, and And they went to it, and about halfway through, the prosecutor who was assigned to actually run the trial, do the trial work, he stopped the trial and dismissed in the middle of it and apologized to the jury for even bringing this piece of crap to him. So, I understand. It's
tough being a PA. People think they see the movies.
That's hard, yeah.
They don't realize you have to know the law. You have to prepare for court. You're on the stand. You have to present the evidence, the discovery of the Brady.
And you don't have that big law enforcement badge just sticking people's faces either.
No.
you got to get their cooperation.
Yeah, you have to get their cooperation.
You can't threaten them with jail.
I always believe in being a gentleman.
Yeah.
Yeah, you win more. You never want to come in tough. Here I am, a PI. That's fascinating. Well, they don't realize it's a tough business.
Yeah, it is.
And you better have a little law background if you really want to be good at it.
What do you do when you find out maybe the person is guilty versus he is innocent?
Well, I'm not bound by lawyer-client privilege. If someone's guilty, then I'm going to back off, or I have to give the findings if they're guilty.
Yeah.
I can't. I'm not going to go up there and fabricate something.
Yeah.
Yeah. As a private detective, we have client privilege, but we don't have the same as lawyer-client privilege when it comes to the law. If the courts ask me to testify, I have no choice but to testify to it.
Yeah. So I think one last thing, and I think we need, since this is a mob show, we need to know a little bit about your connection with the Gotti situation and John Alight. A lot of our fans out there may have seen this on Facebook. There's this huge battle going between John Gotti Jr. and this John Alight, and who is a guy who claims to have done a lot of things, and they have approached you to do a little private eye work on
that. Well, I'm not doing private. I wouldn't take money. I can't
at least investigate it.
I've told them I will, and I'm in the preliminary stages of looking at it.
But you told them that the facts are going to fall the way they fall.
Always do. I'm not going to take one side or another.
Right.
I never do that. I pointed out even before they were discussing it that I don't take offers as a PI. I don't take offers for financial reasons.
Right.
I don't want to tarnish my reputation by taking money. So
you feel like maybe because if they give you money, that then you have to give them the outcome that they expect?
I think when it comes to organized crime matters, it's not that. It's more, you were paid. You were paid to do this. You don't want that type of image. It's best to, if you're going to do it, I know people would take a pay. I don't. Not when it comes to OC cases. I didn't, for example, when I worked with the Bureau, that was different. I'm on their payroll. And this was after I worked freely all these years. I mean, most of the years I didn't charge them. I could have. I mean, they offered me money from day one. I wouldn't do that. That's against my personal principles.
You were also, because you work for the union and you're a
trustee. I was making money. It's just something personal inside that I've never had a lot of money. I've always been, a break edge point. I could go either way. Mm-hmm. I have credit cards that I owe money on, but I'm happy. I'd rather be that way. And live, a simple life that make a lot of money. I know this documentary's coming out, and as you know, De Niro eventually may do something.
Yeah, let's talk about that.
Well, the documentary's
we'll
called...
end up with that right there. You were approached by Robert De Niro to do your life story.
Well, no, what happened is Bob De Niro and I are personal friends, and he wanted to do a story about Accardo.
I thought it was your story. Okay.
Yeah, he came to me about Accardo. And wanted to do something, and that's how it started with Gus Russo. It was one of the early people to write about Accardo. Now Gus is working on the Gennady Vasilenko book, which I understand is going to be quite a success. It's almost out for. But De Niro and I became quite close to each other. We may disagree politically, but I can tell you this: he's a down to earth guy.
Yeah, I've heard he's a pretty good guy
and
easy to work with.
Yeah, Gavin O'Connor, I know very well. I knew Gavin O'Connor, who made the movie The Warrior. Mm-hmm. We discussed some things early on. His dad died, but his dad died. So no, there's a lot of people. I've been approached by a number of studios already about a movie, and I'm sure knowing De Niro, I could always talk to him, and he'd be interested.
Yeah.
But at this stage, he's busy with his other movie. People always ask. Let's get De Niro for this. Let's get De Niro because of the publicity reasons.
Oh, yeah.
I don't do things like that.
So there's a trailer out there called Mr. Undercover. Yes. Somebody shot some footage on you on your life as a documentary. So, but we don't know when that's coming out.
It's supposed to be out, I understand, around August 30th. Okay. But don't hold me to it. It's supposed to be on Netflix,
Netflix.
And they're getting rave reviews already. It's done quite professionally.
No, I looked at the trailer. It's a first-class operation.
Yeah, they have Tom Watt from England. I mean, there's quite a few people.
Yeah.
They got Tommaso Salmi, who's from Sweden.
Yeah.
And originally lives both there in Italy, and a number of other people. Mike Werner from Germany, or he's from Sweden too.
Are they screening it anywhere that you know?
No, they're still cutting.
They haven't got it all together. There's a trailer out there, but there's no.
There's so much
anywhere yet.
There's quite a lot to do yet.
Yeah,
but they're not going to. They're just going to go straight to Netflix, or they're not going to do a theatrical at all.
Oh, I don't know what he's doing with it. I mean, there's. From what I get, I haven't really been. I talked to him, but I don't get into that.
Yeah,
I mean, this is kind of good, great timing because it seems like all of this swelling interest in the mob.
Yeah, one of the things that I'm not big on is people call me a hero in that. I'm not big on that stuff. I don't consider myself one. Yeah, I've always maybe it's my own humility. The only thing I'm vain about is my stomach. I can't stand that. That's the only thing. I lost my hair. I'm losing my hair.
But man, I'm not, hit the jogging track.
Yeah, I'm not. Well, I got a bad heart. And I got bad legs.
You're screwed.
I got this wound that I injured in the military. Re-injured in the military.
I was going to ask you about that, but we don't have a visual for his arm.
Yeah,
his arm
I injured it. I had a burn on it, but when I was in the military. I re-injured it. As a result, they had to literally take a chunk off my leg and put it on this bulbous look at it.
Okay.
So I cover it up so people don't get too shocked by it.
Interesting.
But I try to be down to earth, even as a private detective.
Yeah, verify that. I'll vouch for that. You are.
You know, and I don't want to carry airs. I'm not like that. I'm too simple. I was a union leader. I'm a working class guy.
You understand being one of the guys.
Yeah,
certainly. I look at the dates here. It was 17 years when you were working undercover and you were working the union. You could have easily taken kickbacks.
Sure.
You could have, you know, if you were the trustee, you know, that probably put you in a position of power and an authority that were people like, well, no, who is going to question?
Believe
your
me, between them and the Russia mafia, in a heartbeat,
you wouldn't think these guys
were multimillionaire.
Yeah, wouldn't they be like, you know?
They did. I mean, I've been offered a lot of money. It's just that I have to.
You got to live with yourself.
I got to live with myself. Integrity. I can't do that. I really can't do that. Especially with my big mouth. You know, I'd be violating the position of trust to myself. Mm-hmm. Yeah, my own personal fiduciary.
Yeah, I gotcha. You're a fiduciary to yourself.
You're a hero. It's more, like Gary Jenkins and the work that he did when he went into the law enforcement in 71, and it was a year on the street.
A couple years
on the street. But, he really kind of sees himself as a crime fighter.
Yeah, that's more like
that. That sounds more like kind of like you see this injustice like Red Wimette saw, and you're like, I can't just let this pass me by.
No. People always ask me, weren't you afraid? Would you go to, because I've been ready to be frisked. I have a price tag on my head. You know, during my business, you didn't have time to be afraid. Mm-hmm. You're too busy thinking. And so you don't. If you go into these things with fear, then you're never going to make it. In the undercover business, if you show any fear whatsoever, they're going to smell you out. You're going to be in trouble. It's very careful, especially in Russia. That there's no cavalry coming over the hill. No. You're on your own.
No code word.
What do you think they're going to say once you're dead? Well, we neither confirm nor deny he was working for us.
You're going to be speaking into your little button on your lapel.
That's typical. If you call the CIA, they'll say we neither confirm nor deny. What
you're
talking about?
I don't know who this dude is.
The FBI will speak up a little bit because I've always had a good relationship and they've always spoken highly of me.
Yeah.
And it was funny, when I was testifying in front of Congress, the Republicans were lionizing me, you know, they're making me out to be a gutsy guy, an American hero and that. Get at the truth. Let's get at the truth.
Yeah.
You know, let's do something for the people of this country and Canada, those entries that get ripped off.
I mean, you grew up poor. Your dad was in the mob, ends up in prison. So here you're in this life that you kind of grow up into. And do this work, and like you talk in the story we told earlier in this episode, where you're like, well, these guys, they're just a guy trying to feed his family, and he's kind of locked out of things because the mob has this level of control, and here you're in a position to maybe make a difference.
Yeah, well, that's exactly right. You know, it takes courage, too. I mean, yes, you got to be courageous, but that doesn't mean be stupid. Yeah. But also, at the same time, don't think of yourself in anything more than just being a person that may have a little more courage than somebody else. That's all. It's hard. It's hard because you have to live with yourself. You don't know who's looking over your shoulder.
Well, I mean, but, even to this day, I mean, the fact that you have a book out.
Yeah.
And you talk about this. You appeared at the Mob World Summit. You just came in because of your love for this, and we have to thank you for that. But I mean, the work that you did, you know, at the end of the day, it has to speak for itself.
Yeah. Well, the mob's not going to do it. The Cosa Nostra. Some of the family, on my Facebook. You know, so that's the adversary that I'm concerned about the most. I do have Russian Mafia, and I do have Al-Qaeda and some terrorist groups that would like to see me dead. Mm-hmm. You know, that, yes. So, but the thing is, I do have good protection, things that I can't get into. That's why I'm living in Williamsburg. We have the farm over there, the CIA farm. Yeah. So, but it's very good. I worry about my family, not myself. I'm not the type to worry anymore. I lived this life so long. You know, I call it life on the edge. I've lived it so long that you become acclimated to it.
Yeah.
It's your family that you don't want to see hurt. With the mob, it's not the mob itself. It's a wannabe. Somebody thinks they're going to ingratiate themselves with the mob. They're going to try to take you out.
Yeah, the real deal mob guy is like, there's no percentage.
No,
it's
no,
a losing game.
Yeah, well, especially now. I mean, what I've had to say
for
like, them, 10 years
to
ago.
Do anything with you, it's all done.
Yeah. If it was 89 when you were outed, and then you had to leave Buffalo at the time.
Well, I left Buffalo, yes.
And then you were no longer the trustee or the manager of the union.
No, I had quit prior to that because of a dispute with Danny Sansonese. I went into the hazardous waste business and started, cleanup, but that was control, too. They took all my money, and I was told they wouldn't. I was assured they would not, but they did. They scared me. But, I don't do things for revenge. I would never do that. Mm-hmm. I don't like revenge. You do think, I could see easy, because sure you get angry at people. Never strike back at anger. Yeah, that's a no-no. Think about it for a while. Do what's right.
Well, I would think, the movie, the book, the public
speaking.
No,
the book. We didn't ever mention the title of the book.
It's
The Triangle Exit.
Yeah, the reason I haven't been promoting it.
I noticed that you haven't been promoting it.
Yeah, the reason I haven't is I have a publisher that's stealing all my money.
No.
Yeah,
really?
So now we're coming up with a new, I canceled the contract some time ago. And I have a new publisher coming out.
Okay.
And also, I'm working on a new book.
All right.
So it'll be that's going to pick it up.
And I'll know when this happens
because
I'll watch it on Facebook.
Right.
Make
right.
Sure we pump it up.
Yeah, I'm coming up with a new book. But it's too bad. I mean, this guy. One of the problems I had with him. I'm over in Germany at a book fair, and they're showing the photograph of De Niro and I sitting at the table. With my book in front of them, and they're trying to promote their company. See, we arranged this, they said.
No.
We arranged. I told them then and there, why are you lying about that? You didn't arrange this. I mean, you don't know De Niro. Like, you're trying to take credit for something that you don't do things like that.
Yeah.
That's, they're trying to bolster themselves.
Yeah, interesting.
And I don't appreciate that. But then they stole the money. They gave me the wrong numbers. They fudged the numbers, which happens.
You're not the first person I've heard story from, but variety of different book publishers. So
yeah.
Has anybody optioned the movie rights to this?
Well, there's a number of people. There's a number of
cover coming out.
Yeah, they have a number of people talking to us now. We have people from Europe here in the United States that are discussing the movie rights.
Yeah.
The end of this week, I have to get together with my I'm getting a call from my new agent. Once I get back early next week, he's going to be calling me. We're going to start planning things properly. And it's not for me. I have to do whatever I do, I have to do to protect my family now.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I'm getting long in the tooth. I'm not afraid of death. I don't want to die. I don't have a death wish, but I'm not afraid of it.
All right.
You'd be more afraid if something happened to your family.
Well, that, of course, yes. Yeah. Or somebody because of me, some innocent bystander. I get sick every time I see the news. I see this guy shooting here, or this guy, the police being killed here. What is this world doing?
I know, it's
crazy.
Are
we that sick in the head that these things are happening? It just... bizarre.
Yeah.
It's like the drugs I see. You'd be surprised at the amount of drugs on the street. And I'm not talking marijuana. This is heroin, meth, fentanyl. It's all over the place.
Yeah,
we have destroyed a society.
I know. It's crazy. It's crazy, crazy, crazy.
Yep.
It's an incredible story, Ron.
Well, thank you. Thank
Thanks
you
a lot for doing this.
Thank you, my friend.
Nobody else ever thanks you. Thank you for the work that you do.
Oh, thank you.
You know, the common man,
yeah,
he just wants a job, you know.
That's how I am.
That's all I ever wanted,
you know, take care of that little guy, because they don't have a voice.
Yeah.
That always bothered me. They've always been there for me.
Yeah.
When I was down and out, who came to me? And it doesn't have to be, the black community always supported me, always. American Indians supported me. The white communities supported me. Even the Italians never went against me. You know, the Italian community, they stayed
community,
with me.
Yeah,
and they still are. Because of the working class. Not everybody in the Italian is in the mob.
Yeah,
people don't realize that just because you have an Italian last name
or
even a Russian name. I have some legitimate Russian, and I have Muslim friends.
Yeah.
I believe in people.
Is there a Muslim mob?
Well, yeah, called Al-Qaeda. ISIS, yeah.
ISIS.
Yeah, no. I mean, you're...
You mean that's overall, not just like a political movement, a religious movement? It's really more of a...
Well,
there's like Syrians in the United States. There's a Syrian...
El Nusra.
Lebanese, the mob. Michaels from down in El Paso area. The there's a St. Louis.
St. Louis.
Group of that.
Well, they use religion as an excuse.
Yeah, this has nothing to do with religion.
Yeah, then other people condemn Islam because they say there's too much killing and they arrange for killing. It's good to kill. Our Bible says that.
Mm-hmm.
Our own Bible, if you look at what happened at Jericho. You know, that we're going to kill all the people.
Yeah, killed everybody.
You know,
that's Old Testament.
Yeah, I mean, people better respect each other. The only way you're going to solve this is through that simple word, respect.
Yeah.
You know, don't condemn everybody. You know, it's unfortunate, but, you know, don't be blamed, but everybody learn to get together. Pick each other up, and it works.
Yeah. All right. Thanks, Ron.
Thanks, everybody.
What about your public service announcement here?
Okay. What'd you say?
Oh, this was cueing you for your public service.
We're gonna do a little public service announcement here, and then we will get out of here. If you have a friend or relative that has a problem with drugs or alcohol, make your first call to First Call. Call 816-361-5900, or go to their website www.firstcallkc.org. What do you got to say to that, Aaron?
Folks, if you love true crime and the mob and want to know more, you need to get the documentary that started it all, Gangland Wire. Before there was a podcast, before there was an app, before Gary's book, there was his movie, his documentary, Gangland Wire. You could rent it on Amazon, but you go give a $25 donation and Gary will send you the DVD, which has a lot more material that's not available on Amazon. And then after you're done watching that, you're going to want to get his book, Leaving Vegas.
How FBI wiretaps ended mob domination of Las Vegas casinos.
And that book is a great read, but it's an actually better listen, because if you get the Kindle version of the book for $1.99, if you buy the regular book.
Yeah, right.
Right. Actually, there's hyperlinks to video transcriptions of the actual audio that you're reading from that book, and it's the words from the mouth of the men that did it. And there's so much great detail in that book about the skim that you're going to want to know more. You might even take a plane and fly to Kansas City, and if you do that, you're going to want to get Gary's app, the Kansas City Mob Tour app. For $1.99, you can take your own personal turn-by-turn tour of notorious mob locations in and around Kansas City. And of course, remember to share, support, and subscribe to Gangland Wire on the iTunes. We really need you to give us a 5-star review.
Yes, we do. All right, Ron, I appreciate it so much.
Thank you.
Say goodnight, Aaron.
Goodnight, Aaron. Music provided by Odd-O-Matic. Follow them on Twitter at Odd-O-Matic Music.